or sanctions this next period, and as you all know, Chaplain Mathry, who is a chaplain at the McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary, where he comes into direct contact with these problems, is going to share this hour, and we are going to follow about the same scheme that Paul just followed with me. That is, I'm going to make a few comments about the problem as I see it as a lawyer, and then Chaplain Mathry will make a few comments, and then we'll let you people talk too. I always start at the 13th chapter of Romans. And I'd like to read a few verses from this to you so that you can get all your hackles up right away about what I'm going to say. This is the 13th chapter, starting with the first verse. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. You notice, please, that the word used here is authority, not law. And those that exist, that is the authorities, have been instituted by God. Therefore, he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of him who is in authority? Then do what's good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do what's wrong, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain. I suppose sword here means authority to inflict some sort of forceful restraints upon people. Maybe punishment. He, that is the authority, he is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. He is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. And that's through the fifth verse, and then it goes on. It seems to me that the question about, in the broadest gauge that we're talking about this morning, is the criminal law of a state an agency for wreaking vengeance? We had started talking out about vengeance in the first place. Maybe we could have given this a different twist. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, so forth. Or are we talking simply about enforcement of certain restrictions which we lay down? And what is the purpose for which we enforce these limitations upon human conduct? I think perhaps the best contribution that I can make in a few moments is to start from the top of this thing and say, what is the difference, as you see it, between criminal law and civil law? And why do we have two kinds of law, really? There are two different emphases here, one under the name of criminal law and under civil law. Let me give a very specific illustration and then ask the question again. Suppose that a man steals my automobile. If he has the automobile, I, as the owner of it, may go to a court of law and ask the court to order that person to return my car to me. That is a civil action. It's a private action brought by one person in the courts against another person. We call this a private or a civil. It's a non-criminal action. On the other hand, the stealing of the automobile, a larceny, a theft, is obviously a crime. And the state, acting through its prosecuting attorney, can proceed against that person to inflict upon him some sort of penalty. Penalty, of course, coming from the word which means hurt or injury or harm or pain. Penalty. Now, why this difference? Notice also that there are very major differences in the kinds of procedures and the kinds of evidence that is used in the civil action as compared to the criminal action. Very major differences. Those of you who are concerned about the activity of the United States Supreme Court in recent years are probably more concerned here more than anywhere else. The constant comment that I hear is, isn't the Supreme Court going too far in protecting the criminal? Making it too tough for a policeman to get a conviction, to make the arrest, and to get the evidence? Aren't the burdens of proof and the evidence requirements stacked too high, and all of the refinements about not making arrest until there's a warrant, and so forth and so forth. And there's a very major difference between the kinds of procedures that are used for criminal action and civil actions. And parenthetically, may I say that it's not at all clear what is a criminal action and what is a civil action. For example, if the state brings an action against the juvenile delinquent, this is not a criminal action. It's a civil action for the child's protection. And the procedural rules are not the rules which we would use for a crime. Or if the state brings an action against the person who is alleged to be mentally ill, to remove that person from society against that person's will, and put that person into an institution and hold him there against his will, this is not a criminal action. And the rules of procedure and the burdens of evidence are not those of crime, but are those of a civil action. Notice that in the two cases that I've just mentioned to you, the juvenile and the mental incompetent, and we could get others, that the result, as far as the defendant is concerned, is the same result. He's taken out of circulation and put away behind bars against his will, deprived of his freedom, of his liberty. It's not always clear, this magic line between a criminal action and a civil action. But let's pretend that it is for a moment so we can at least talk to each other. In the civil action, that is the private action, where I sue you in Replevin to make you give my car back to me, all that I need do is to show by a preponderance of the evidence that you took my car, the car is mine, and you ought to give it back to me. A preponderance of the evidence is, and shortly as I can state it, is to say, imagine a scale, a balance out here, where you put in your evidence that it's your car, and I put in my evidence that it's my car, and since I'm the one who's asking the court to do something, I have the burden of proof. But all that I have to do in a civil action is just to have any amount which is greater than yours, a preponderance, just enough to tilt the scale in my favor a little bit, that's all. But when you get into a criminal action, the state, as the plaintiff, must prove beyond any reasonable doubt that the person is guilty. That means you put your evidence in and the scale has to go like this. A very heavy burden of proof for the state, beyond any reasonable doubt. Lay people are fond of saying beyond a shadow of a doubt, if that means anything. If that's clear, why, okay, it's got to be beyond a shadow of a doubt. That's the difference, you see, in a civil action, a little bit. In a criminal action, a great big bit. Why? What is the difference? Why do we do this? Is it because we're soft-hearted about a man who steals the car when we are letting, when we're going to fine him, charge him a $500 fine, and not soft-hearted about him if he takes my car and injures it, the same act exactly, and I sue him as a private person and it's going to cost him $500 damages? Is there really a difference between taking $500 out of his pocket in damages or $500 out of his pocket in a fine? It's $500 out of his pocket. He's that much poorer either way. Why this difference? Why have we gone out of our way to make a distinction and to make such different rules for procedure and evidence between the criminal action and the civil action? I've asked the question about 10 times. Now, if we had more time to fiddle with it, I'd stop for 5 minutes and let you ponder that. Because my deep down suspicion is that there's probably not more than two or three people in this room who have ever thought of why there is a difference between a criminal and a civil action. All right, now if you will think about that problem real hard for a moment, then we are in a position where we'll be able to start talking about it sensibly. Is it because we do not want private people to start feuding with each other in a long-haul sort of vendetta, family feuds where we go on potting them off by the dozens, aunts, uncles, and cousins, you know, the sort of hillbilly thing that we read about once in a while, and we want the state to be the avenger, to come in and apply the rope or the whip or the branding iron or whatever other delicate penalty you can happen to think of, so that it gratifies, I'm the person who's been wronged now, and the state doesn't want me to avenge myself, but the state acts as God's agent to wreak vengeance on that defendant so that I, as the injured person, can stand by and say, thank you, I feel so much better now that you've chopped his head off. So that there will not be feuding now. are we going to concede that we as human beings cannot live together without having somebody avenge the wrong? That's a possible argument. It's also possible to say that we shouldn't need vengeance at all, that the proper function of the law, man's law, the law that man uses, this system of making laws which God gave man, is not there to wreak vengeance at all, but is there for some other purpose of helping man get along and living together. Now, those purposes might be purposes not of punishment or of vengeance, but rather purposes of protecting society from this man's wrongful conduct, injurious conduct, protection, not vengeance, and it might be a desire to help this man become rehabilitated, to become a good citizen, a useful citizen, rather than a citizen who is living a life which is not beneficial to him nor to us, not a useful citizen. That is, rehabilitation rather than punishment, protection of society rather than vengeance. These might be our motivations. Now, if those are true, then why do you make the differences in procedure and proof between criminal actions and civil actions? You must think that point through. You haven't got time, so I'll tell you why. All right. Reason for it is this. In the fair game competitive struggle, which is the way that we find out things where we make our guesses about answers that we can't know scientifically. Can I incorporate all that by reference? Do you remember everything I've been trying to say the last few days about the fact that a legal problem is one where you will never know the real answer, where you've got to make guesses? See, you don't have a legal question if you know the answer, or if you can find it out scientifically. It's only when you've got a guess. Now, when you get down to the problem of getting as much evidence as you can to help your guess be a little bit more intelligent, the best way that we have of getting at the historical truth of things which are not determinable scientifically is to test people's veracity by cross-examination. It's a contest. It's a struggle. Two people appear before a judge, and they make their statements, they cross-examine each other and they test each other's veracity, driven by the same pressures that we see in competition, that is personal gain. This is the way it happened. This is for my advantage to prove that this is true. The other man says, that's the way it happened. It's to my advantage to prove that it's true. And he has the strongest possible goad to bring out all of the evidence on his side and produce all of this for the judge so that the judge can sift it out and make the best decision which is possible. Given that context, look at the private action where I'm after a man for damages, and the state is the referee. I struggle, he struggles, the state judges. The state won't let him get out of hand, the state won't let me get out of hand. The state is the moderator, the governor on the engine that keeps us from going to excesses. Shift over to the criminal action. Who is the prosecuting attorney in the criminal action? The state. If the state is the prosecutor and also the judge, the governor, then where is the protection for the person who is accused of crime? He doesn't have really an impartial body sitting in judgment of a contest between two other persons, but rather he is struggling against the very agency, the very authority, the very body which will judge him. Now, if he is to be subjected to judgment under these circumstances, it becomes very necessary to weight the scales in advance so that the state will not be able to run over him with minimum amounts of evidence. Because you know as well as I know that states can be corrupt and states can get out of hand and there can be tyrannies and dictatorships which are injurious to the public good just as well as not. Therefore, in advance, we weight the scales in favor of the defendant and against the state in order to protect the individual from being tyrannized by his government. We don't have to do that in the case of the private action where it is simply a question of which party can make the better showing of what happened, the preponderance of evidence, because he has there the neutral agency of the state or the court which represents the authority of the state casting judgment and putting the limitations there. Our entire system of government, our theory of government, is one of checks and balances. The states check the federal government, the federal government checks the states, the administration of the nation checks the judiciary checks the Congress checks everybody, everybody's checking everybody. Inside the court itself, the judge checks the jury checks the judge, one lawyer checks the other, the clients check each other, everybody is checking everybody. And that's the only way that we've learned how to work efficiently, this system that we call checks and balances. This is the reason for the difference between criminal and civil actions. And if once one grants that, you should be able to see how important it is to make these procedural differences, the evidence differences, the great preponderance of evidence in the criminal cases, beyond any reasonable doubt of guilt that you don't have to have in the civil action because your freedom is protected otherwise in the civil actions. Now beyond that, the problem becomes of one of what do you hope to accomplish with the person after you have found that he is guilty of some crime, that he has broken one of our criminal rules. Then what should the state's attitude be? Are we really there to punish? Are we there to wreak vengeance? Are we there to rehabilitate? Are we there for his good or ours or both? And I rather suspect that Chaplain Mathry, you're in a better position to talk about this than I. Or if you intended to talk about something else, do it. But whatever you like, you talk for a while, and then we'll see where we go from there.
What's our great problem? What's our great enigma? What is it that confronts us, that man has to constantly deal with, both in relationship to himself, to other people, and to God? It's a problem of distance. I'd like to read a little portion of scripture. I guess it isn't illegal. From Genesis 3, 9 to 13. And the Lord called unto Adam and said unto him, Where art thou? And he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. And he said, Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldst not eat? And the man said, The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat. And the Lord said, God said unto the woman, What is this that thou hast done? And the woman said, The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. It's an old story. I wonder if we've really seen the implications of this little story. Basic problem here was a problem of distance, sense of a relationship was broken. God and man made to live with each other. Somehow or other, there was a break here. Evidence of this break is the fact that man refused to take responsibility for himself. And of course, this is the mark of maturity. This is that which probably gets us all into difficulty when we get into difficulty. Notice they said they were uncovered. They were naked. He says, How do you know? When God exposed them, they felt utterly exposed, undone. And then Adam pulled a real trick, which is so basic to us. He said, you know, the woman you gave me, she's responsible. But he did more than that. He went beyond this and he said, the woman thou gave me, see, you're really responsible. If you hadn't given me this woman, see, I wouldn't have done it. And the woman said, See, it was the serpent's fault. She too was refusing to take responsibility. So the distance went like this. And how is this distance going to be bridged? The ancient theological remedy is forgiveness. But how does one accept forgiveness if he doesn't have any need for it. He doesn't see any need for it. So the bridge can't be bridged. This distance can't be lessened until we see our need for it to be lessened. So the broken relationship is the problem. Distance. The great divide. And from this point on, all of Scripture is geared to how can we lessen this distance between man and himself. I didn't do it. He's divided against himself. She did it. He's divided against his brother. You did it. He's divided as over against God. All the rest of Scripture and the whole Christian church digging with this problem. This is the great divide. How do we lessen this distance? Man's search, how to close the gap. Certainly, parents are God's representatives in this respect. And they may either open or close the gap. They may make the gap wider, or they may close it, help close it, make it possible for these relationships to be restored. But the key is the type of relationship that is given to make it possible for this person to say, I did it. To make it possible for her to say, I'm responsible for what I did and what I do. But until we come to this point, where are we? We're still divided. Sunday we heard the way of the closest distance is forgiveness. But man has no need or sees no need of forgiveness apart from a relationship. When one isn't related, he has no real feelings of guilt. Therefore, he has no feeling of needing forgiveness, either with God, or to man, or himself. Thus, as the relationship goes, or grows, our sin increases. Isn't this what Paul says? A sense of guilt at breaking a relationship grows as a relationship grows. Our sense of sin grows as a relationship grows. Our sense of brokenness in our relationship, that we're missing something, grows as we begin to be related. And thus meaning comes into our lives. But how about those who haven't this relationship, live apart from this? As far as I'm concerned, the basic sin is the brokenness in relationship, breaking relationships. And there's really no meaning apart from this. Crying, I feel, is the result of a broken relationship. It's isolation. Feeling of isolation from oneself and from other people, from all that has meaning. This is the one with whom we are dealing. The distance separates. No guilt for many, because there's no relationship. No feeling of guilt without this relationship. And so there can be a sinning without any feeling. Many know what is right. They've been brought up in homes to know what is right. They can recite the Ten Commandments, but it doesn't mean a thing, because they've never had the relationship in their lives to make it real, to make it a part of their lives. So that which is right, we do. But as man is related meaningfully, the isolation is broken, and he knows what is right, and he wants to do it, and does it. Because it means something in relationship to someone. Someone gets hurt when I break a relationship. Every commandment, you can see, is a commandment in relationship to someone. It doesn't stand by itself as just an arbitrary law. It's to preserve a relationship. As man is related meaningfully, the distance is closed. Punishment, thus, simply by a trial and error, might arrest an action. If you punish a child, he may stop doing something if you punish him enough, but he'll be doing something else. And same is true with punishment, simply for punishment's sake of the offenders against the law. Punishment doesn't change, only a relationship changes. Punishment may arrest an activity, but it doesn't change. It just finds another form. It's like changing the energy. We never lose energy, it just changes form. Thus, punishment, to quote, pay for a crime, unquote, is entirely unrealistic. We can't pay for crime, we can't pay for what we have done, and it doesn't change anything. So it seems to me entirely unrealistic that our means of dealing with offenders against the law simply be one of punishment. And if we are to deal with the offenders to help reduce the isolation that we are talking about, to help break this broken relationship with himself and with other people and with God, it doesn't really seem logical either to further increase the isolation by separation. This just compounds the problem. And this has resulted in hostility and anger and resentment and increased distance and increased crime. The need instead is to break the isolation, to break down the distance, so that man can have the opportunity to become a man, responsible for himself. Now granted, even though he may have a relationship, he may not become rightly with another person, he may not become related to God, but he has the opportunity, and he may. This we need to give. Thus, we need to be the living gospel, that men may have the opportunity, at least, to be related to other men and to God. Now, this is perhaps an oversimplification, because there are some with whom, no matter how much you try, you're still going to have to isolate them from society. They simply won't get along. And there are many other compounded problems, but this, in brief, is at least the philosophy under which we work in proclaiming the gospel, being the gospel. Now, I was asked by Dr. Rieke what my ideas were on capital punishment. For a long time, I felt, along with a friend of mine who said, I believe that every major offender should have a suspended sentence at the end of a rope. This is certainly the feeling of many, because it's very costly when you stop to think about it. It costs at least $4,000 a year to keep a man locked up and another $3,000-$4,000 to support his family. It's not very efficient. Maybe we should just do away with it. But this isn't certainly our goal as Christian people. And if we follow the same basic philosophy of distance, since capital punishment must certainly contribute to the most severe kind of isolation, I would feel it would be inevitably wrong, because it contributes to this sin of distance rather than helps reduce it, or making possible any reduction in this distance so that the person can become a person. That's all I'll say for now.
Well, now we can talk. It's perfectly obvious that we aren't going to be able to satisfy very many questions in the brief time we have remaining this morning. And maybe, again, are you going to be here next week?
I'm not. I wish I would.
We'll take another run at criminal law again later anyway. But I have one question I'd like to ask of the chaplain, first of all, and then I'll deliver him to your tender mercies. He talks about crime as being essentially a,
if I understand this correctly, as a isolation or a breach in the relationship. Now, I can understand this if you're talking about a relationship between a man and a man. If it alienates one human being from another human being, it's a wrong that's done by one human being against another. What do you do, though, with the crimes that we do have? There are perhaps not many of them, but there are some. Drug addiction, attempted suicide, and we can think of some others where you have crimes without human victims. Now, drug addiction may indeed hurt a family someplace, but not necessarily. If we think of a person who has no family, no one dependent upon him, he just goes up someplace where he isn't going to drive an automobile or anything else, and violates the law by using drugs, so that there is not harm to an individual or the similar guy who attempts suicide. This is a crime. The alienation that occurs is a crime not between a man and another man, necessarily, but I suppose one could say an alienation which occurs between man and his creator, God.
And himself.
Now, if we start punishing people criminally, putting them in jail for this, you're going to jail too. There's no question about this. If this is an alienation from God, brother, you had it. I think you read the passage.
The thing is, doing this, and whether this is right or not, this is the question.
But is it an acceptable philosophical basis to say that crime can be defined as being a relationship of man from anyone other than another man, where it wreaks an injury upon another human being, where you need a definite need for protection of other people? I'm not fighting the theology of the thing, but I'm fighting the fact that as a lawyer, I would like to think that I can make human courts, everything I've said the last 4 days, work in the context of protecting one human being from another one, efficiently, economically. And I'm not at all sure that you've given me any guideline that I can work with at all if I've got to take into consideration alienation of man from God, because every one of us is then a criminal by this sort of a definition, and there aren't enough jails to accommodate that many people. Yeah.
The problem is that we're doing this in the sense of convicting people for this type of crime.
Would you say let's get rid of it?
I would say it needs to be handled another way, yes.
Isn't it on the case of drug addiction that the case in the federal courts is when they found them peddling it, that's when they're convicted?
No, just have it. Yeah. Even if it's for your own use, if you got it, it's illegal, it's a federal crime.
Classic illustration of a crime where you don't necessarily have a victim on the other end of it except yourself.
Right.
Excuse me for pointing at you. Except yourself.
I thought I'd get rid of mine. We have a lot of that, though.
Yeah.
I mean, there are...
I suppose that you see more drug addicts than almost anybody else. The federal penitentiaries give them.
Yeah.
Does society have an obligation to protect a man from himself?
Don't just stand there and answer.
I think we have certainly a responsibility for one another, and this is what we do when we commit a person who is mentally in need of help. If we can get the person to voluntarily commit himself to a hospital for treatment, this is a good thing. If he won't, then we commit them.
Don't and get so, away with that.
And I think we have a responsibility to each other in this regard.
No, I'm talking about, doesn't society have a responsibility to protect me if I am foolish enough to indulge in dope or endanger my own life?
Or smoke cigarettes.
I think that we, this would go back to the point of assuming responsibility for yourself. And I am.
What if I cannot assume responsibility for myself?
If you're not injured someone else, then I would say my responsibility stops if you choose to pursue your own foolishness. Yeah.
I disagree.
Yeah. Well, you're, it's your privilege.
I think the attitude that we have to take is one of brothers in Christ, and we have to treat one another as human beings. And I think that socially or in the eyes of the world, at least morally, we do have an obligation to assist someone who is our fellow man fight a battle against something within himself or if he needs to protect himself from something within, we do have a moral obligation to help him.
What obligation?
I think we have a responsibility, for example, if a fellow should start on dope, for example. We know that it's not good for him physically, possibly also mentally. If someone is extremely bothered by social pressures or the pressures of business, I think we have, and he's looking for an answer, for relief from the internal pressures, I think by counseling and by guidance and Christian charity that we do all we can to help this person get over this rough spot in his life.
All right, this brotherly concern, should we take little action in this regard? How about if you are killing yourself because you're overeating, should we commit you?
Well, I think this almost comes to the same thing as suicide.
Yeah.
A person who either mentions a drug addict or a suicidal intent, they don't want, in most cases, our assistance or our interference. But they are mentally incompetent, and they need, therefore, where are they going to stop with themselves and perhaps injure or trouble another person's life, and then where, of course, are we going to draw the line for the use of interference?
Well, the whole point is, most potential suicides are extending a cry for help if we know how to listen. We ought to be listening.
Chaplain, I hate to interrupt you, but I know the prayer practice starts pretty quick.
You're going up to coffee.
Yeah.
Okay, get him up to the coffee pot. Came over good there. You work on him.